It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today it's eating in Australia, our sister country when it comes to being an upstart on the world food scene. Now, just like us, Australia's young, filled with immigrants, and newly fascinated by food. Sydney Star Chef Bill Granger gives us his take on where to go and what to eat. Well, the Stearns are clamming up in Maine. That is, they're doing the Clamorama dinner at the Maine Diner in Wells. Supercook Sally Schneider has a slick new concept for dried fruit. And just in time for Shrove Tuesday, hear that, pancake day, Anya von Bremsen talks real Russian blini. Then we've the dog days of dieting. Get your leash, guys. All of this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this. Thank you. it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by Super Target. Well, today, Australian star chef Bill Granger takes us on a dining tour of Sydney. Now, Australians may still be throwing those shrimps on the barbie, but they're also seen as the precocious wonders of New World wine and food. And Bill's got an eater's guide to Sydney. Well, crack cook Sally Schneider has stumbled on the perfect marriage, dried fruit and the roasting pan. Global Food Authority and Moscow native Anya von Bremsen talks real-world blini, just in time for Shrove Tuesday. I always think of it as Pancake Day. Then it's the latest diet success story. The secret is having four legs. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine. Hey, Michael, Jane, I'm planning a trip to Maine, and the burning question is, where do you guys like to go to eat lobster?
Almost anywhere along the Maine coast is a great place to eat lobster. There are so many good ones, but when Jane and I drive up there, we want to eat it right away. So we go to the Maine Diner in Wells, Maine, which is in the southwesternmost part of the state. And this place, while it doesn't have the ambiance of the wharfside lobster pound, which is so nice, has some stupendously delicious lobster dishes, including one of the best hot lobster rolls I've ever found, including in the state of Connecticut, where they were invented, and also a dish that they call lobster pie. It's made from the owner's grandmother's recipe, and it's one of those old-fashioned casseroles made with fresh-picked lobster meat, a little bit of the tamale from inside the lobster, and it is one of the most delicious dishes that a lobster lover could ever want.
I'm picturing it all creamy inside and flaky
crust. It is
crust.
All creamy. It's, you know, some people call it lazy man's lobster, but, you know, that's fine with me. I don't mind being lazy when somebody else, you know, picks out these beautiful fresh shards of lobster and puts it in butter in front of me. The Maine Diner, Lynn, is so wonderful because I have to tell you, that part of Maine has turned into outlet city. I mean, it's just one outlet store after another, and it can be a little bit soul-killing if you really go there for the Maine ambiance. But the Maine Diner is not a franchise. It's a mom-and-pop operation, and you know, it truly does have all the great New England specialties. They have lobster, but they also have dynamite roast turkey dinners. They have chicken pot pies. They have homemade baked beans, macaroni and cheese, grape nut pudding. You know, you kind of can't go wrong there.
And back to the shoreline favorites. What they have: terrific fried clams, clam chowder to die for. If you're really a clam lover rather than a lobster lover, you go for the clam-o-rama dinner.
I think clam-o-rama.
I call it clam-o-rama. Excuse
then
me.
Then it's clam-o-rama.
Clam-o-rama dinner, which includes clam chowder, fried whole clams, clam strips, and a clam cake on the side.
What's the difference between a clam strip and a fried clam?
Oh, it's huge. I mean, the fried clam it infers the whole belly, you know, the real gooey, juicy clam. The strip is more like we all used to get at Howard Johnson, sort of
the rubber
chewy
band.
rubber band-like thing. Yeah,
the oceanic rubber band. But, you know, sometimes
But even
that's
these
fine.
Rubber bands are very good. They're tender, and they're sometimes that goo can be a little daunting, the goo in a whole-bellied clam. And it's nice to alternate between the whole-bellied clams and the strips, I find.
They also have a wonderful lobster benedict for breakfast, which is just like an egg benedict, but except the ham part of it has been substituted for crab or lobster.
Well,
it's funny because it sounds, you know, when I'm describing these dishes, it sounds like it would be a swanky place, but it's a very simple little blue and white cafe, and it's charming. And the waitresses are kind of good old style diner waitresses.
Well, I know where my first stop's going to be in May. Hey, guys, thank you.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye-bye, Lynn.
And give me back my evil heart so I can see you as you are in May.
The Stearns are authors of that indispensable guide, Road Food. Now, they're here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go on the website, splendidtable.org. And speaking of finds, how about getting up close and personal with Italy's three world-class foods? Phenomenal balsamic vinegar, you know, the kind that's aged for decades and you sip like a liqueur. Extraordinary Parmigiano Reggiano, and the best melt-in-the-mouth prosciutto you are ever going to eat. Not to mention that secret ham called culatello and fabulous cooking all around. Now, I am talking NPR's trip to Italy in April. You'll explore my old stomping grounds, the region that Italians call the culinary capital of the country, Emilia-Romagna. And you'll see why my family's home territory, Tuscany, is such a siren song. Now, we're going to meet up a couple of times so I can pass on some of my discoveries and we can swap secrets for a great Italy experience. Now, this is an inside Italy tour. Meet the artisans and the cooks firsthand. You can find details on our Italian adventure on the website, splendidtable.org. Food writer Sally Schneider loves to scope out ingredients. She sleuths out new ways of using them, and then she shares her finds with us. Now, you can read Sally, too, in national publications and in her book, A New Way to Cook. Hey, Sally, good to have you back.
Good to be back, Lynn.
So what's your focus of the moment?
I've been thinking about fruit, but not fresh fruit, because these are the days where, for some reason, there doesn't seem to be anything good in my market. And when that happens, I turn to dried fruits. Now, that doesn't seem so dazzling, but really these are little miracles that I keep in my pantry because I'm able to do so much with them.
So what kinds of things do you do?
I'm talking about not just throwing them into things like muffin batters and cereals and oatmeal, that sort of thing. I'm talking about using them as though they were fresh fruits to make marvelous desserts and sauces and confits and even to jazz up savory dishes.
So are you soaking them then?
Beyond soaking. Soaking is the basic idea, Lynn, because we want to reconstitute them. We want to give them back the juices that they've lost when they've dried. But what I found is that if you soak them or warm them in a syrup that is giving them a little bit of sweet, it pulls out and accentuates all the flavors and really begins to bring them back to a texture that is very close to fresh fruit, sometimes even better, as in the case with apricots. Now, the way I discovered this was I'd made a big batch of apricots in a cardamom-scented syrup to give as Christmas gifts, and they were in my fridge, and one day people were coming over, and I had nothing to serve as desserts, and on a whim, I tried roasting them as though they were fresh apricots, with a little butter and a sprinkle of sugar, and they caramelized and were fabulous. We ate them with creme fraiche, and we couldn't believe how delicious they were. After that, it was no stopping me. I was making apricot tarts. I was rolling them into puff pastry, upside down cake. And I've done the same thing with prunes, peaches, and dried cherries.
That is, I never thought of roasting a dried fruit. And yet it makes so much sense because it's already so intensely flavored. You'd get a more intense flavor when you put it into the oven, right?
And it also caramelizes well because it has a good deal of sugar in the fruit. And just the way they are, just fruits that have been plumped, as it were, in a syrup are terrific with yogurt or ice cream or whatever. And once you've done that, you can flavor the syrup if you want. I throw vanilla bean in, sometimes spices, cardamom. Sometimes I splash some alcohol in. I mean, that's where you can go crazy with improvising. You can add herbs if you want and so on. But what happens is it transmutes something homely, say, for example, raisins or white raisins. One day I plumped them up in this sweetened syrup and I threw in a shot of grappa. And I had the most amazing dessert. Nobody could believe it. And of course, it all went to our heads.
Yeah, but you're talking raisins, right?
I'm talking raisins. I'm not talking high-end raisins or glazed anything or gourmet raisins. They turned into something completely other. Now, if you take them one step further and you simmer the fruits in the syrup and let the syrup evaporate, you get a confit, a kind of jam, which can be absolutely divine. I tend to throw in, you know, if I do prunes, I'll throw in walnuts. If I do apricots, I throw in pistachios, that sort of thing. So that's a whole other piece to follow along. You can also use dried fruits in savory dishes using the same basic principle. That is that the dried fruits need to soak up something delicious. So, for example, prunes have a famous affinity for pork and rabbit. You can roll prunes right into the center of a pork roast, and the juices, actually, of the pork roast will kind of plump them up. You can add them to a braise. You can add them to the cavity of a rabbit you're going to roast. They're great in terrines and pâtés. Cherries are my all-time favorite to make simple, quick sauces to go with duck, game birds, chicken, lamb, that sort of thing.
So essentially, the whole idea is soak them in something that tastes good, and then you can play with them.
Soak them with a little bit of heat. Heat is going to be what makes them really soften and drink up the liquid. And in the case of an alcohol, you want to make sure the alcohol is cooked off. So, for example, these famous cherries I just talked about, I simmered them in Madeira until the Madeira was evaporated and glazed them. And I basically had a very savory confit that went perfectly with duck and chicken and that sort of thing.
Another great idea. Sally, thanks.
You're welcome, Lynn. It's been a pleasure.
Food writer Sally Schneider is author of A New Way to Cook. Now, you can get Sally's recipe for essential plumped dried fruit on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're exploring the site, sign up for our weekly newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. Every week, we send you a new quick supper dish. We also send along shopping and technique tips. But best of all, it's free. Now, you can sign up for it, well, you know, splendidtable.org. Coming up, the latest from Australia with Sydney chef Bill Granger and Pancake Heaven Russian style, just in time for Shrove Tuesday. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target, home of Archer Farms, where you can find modern takes on old-time classics like angel food cake, quiche, and garlic bread. Find them online at target.com/supertarget. Look at Australian cookbooks, and I always see these exotic blends like curry leaf and balsamic vinegar in a tomato sauce, but they never seem stagey. I mean, in the Australian context, they seem natural because I think Australia is such a mix of cultures. Well, our guest is one of the chefs that's on top of that food scene in Australia. He cooks, he writes, and he does TV. He's based in Sydney. He is Bill Granger. He launched his career on Breakfast with Bill's Restaurant. Now he has Bill's and Bill's Too with Breakfast, Lunch, and Dinner. Bill Granger's newest book is Bill's Open Kitchen. Hey, Bill, welcome.
Hello, how are you?
I am just swell. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Now, I understand that you have built your fame on scrambled eggs. Can you tell me about this?
I know, it's funny, isn't it? Well, I started making scrambled eggs at my first cafe and restaurant, and they just took off. They just, you know, had a life of their own. I'd never made scrambled eggs before. And all I did was mix in a bit of cream instead of milk and cook them really quickly in a nonstick pan rather than, you know, a slow double boiler or any of those traditional methods. And everyone went crazy. The New York Times said they're the best eggs in the world and called me the egg master of Sydney.
Well, you know, going back to what I was saying about I look at Australian cookbooks because I haven't been to Australia yet. And I always see these exotic blends. I have this sense that there is an Asian grocery store on every corner.
mean, yes, almost. It's, I mean, the supermarkets and the general stores, you know, whereas, look, 15 years ago when I was growing up, you know, you'd never even find basil, you know, or parsley that wasn't curly leaf. And now you can get lemongrass, gungalal, you know, different types of ginger, different sorts of garlics. It's amazing. And that's at local supermarkets.
So what is the food scene in Sydney like now? I mean, what are the main influences now on it?
It swings in circles. Like any city, it has its fashions and it has its moments, and it's influenced by a lot of things, whether it's economic or social or, you know, whatever. But at the moment, the Asian, after it being quiet for a while, everyone got a little bit sick of the Asian influences. It suddenly had a huge upswing again. And suddenly there's a lot of new Asian restaurants that are opening that are really fashionable. We went through a stage of, you know, being much more French and Italian influenced than before they're Japanese. So it goes around.
If we're a first-time visitor, where would you want us to go?
The great thing about Sydney is it's a city that, I mean, everyone in the rest of Australia calls Sydney a bit of, what do they call us? A bit of a tart, because we open ourselves up so well to visitors. We, you know, it's a very easy, accessible city. It's very glossy and shiny and lots of fun. But so it's easy to find things just walking around, but there's, I think, you know, you've of course got to come to Bill's for breakfast. But there's a great restaurant called Longgrain, which is a protege of an Australian chef called David Thompson, who's written a great book on Thai food, who works, has a restaurant in London called Nam. And he's got a wonderful one called Longgrain. And it's a lots of fun. It has a DJ and music as well as the restaurant. Where else is it? There's EXO, which is Neil Perry's, a very famous Australian chef's new restaurant called EXO, which is Asian inspired. Another one, Fratelli Paradiso, which is wonderful pastas. Pizza Mario, which is very simple pizzas, but, you know, very specific, very simple. There's only 8 toppings and you're not allowed to change them. You know, there's anything you want. The great, you know, the great thing about Australia or Sydney, like America, is that you can get any sort of food you want any day of the week. You know, unlike, you know, I spent a holiday in Italy and, you know, you're dying for something different and you might get Northern Italian or you might get, you know, Southern Italian.
Yeah, it's interesting. The Italians tend to eat Italian food.
They eat Italian food.
Is there a particular neighborhood that you would send us to?
Yes. Stay in the Paddington, Darlinghurst area. That's the suburbs that are close to the city. And the downtown area around Circular Quay, which is where the harbour is really developed and has great restaurants now. That's where the Opera House is, around that whole area. It used to be a bit of a no-go tourist area, but now it's actually quite good now.
You mentioned that, like America, you can get almost anything in Sydney. I have always thought of our two countries as being almost sisters, that we're young countries, we didn't have strong traditions, we were populated by people from all over the world, and that when you define our cuisines, you really have to start at a very different place than you might define cuisine, let's say, someplace like Italy. Do you have that take there? I mean, do you feel like you're reinventing something in Australia?
Definitely. I think, you know, the great thing about, Machala Hazan said it, that, you know, the great thing about, you know, what's happening in America and Australia is that we have no history. So you're not, when restaurateurs or chefs are trying to cook, they're cooking to very open audiences who don't have preconceived ideas about what things can be. So that gives you a lot of freedom as a chef. Or, you know, as a restaurateur.
Yeah.
But it's very, you know, comparable to what's happening at home. Australia's a lot smaller. So we, you know, just don't have the population to make things, you know, happen as much as here. And also with, you know, it's so many, with the states as well, it's just so many different areas that each have their own identity.
And
you know, so it's really
hard
to compare.
Is that true in Australia as well? Is the food
regional? like Melbourne and Sydney, definitely, because of the climate, because the climate's changed so much. And, you know, Brisbane. As the further north you get, the more Asian it gets, because it gets hotter. So the Asian food and the spicy food really works with the climate. And the more further south you get, the more European it gets. Melbourne's has the biggest, I think it's the second biggest Greek city outside of Athens in the world.
Wow.
And that's out, and that's outside of any other city in Greece. It's huge, you know, Greek and Italian population.
So you come by the Mediterranean influence, very honestly.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Well, the great thing is, like here, you know, you can travel to different parts of the city and almost, you know, you, it's like visiting another country.
Is the Australian wine industry pushing things as well?
The Australian wine industry's been incredibly important to really spearhead Australian cuisine too, you know, and let people know what's happening in Australia. I know in Britain now, Australian wines outsell French and any wines from anywhere else, which is quite amazing. You know, it wasn't like that 10 years ago. And I know they're starting to be a little bit better known, you know, in the States. But the wines are great. They're, you know, really delicious. They're fresh. They're new world style. They're young. And a lot of our winemakers I know are going, you know, to France and teaching, you know, the very traditional winemakers there how we're doing things, which is quite interesting.
Yeah. Bill Granger, thank you.
Thank you very much, Lynn.
Chef Bill Granger has Bills and Bills 2 in Sydney, Australia, and does a cooking show on Australian television. His latest book is Bill's Open Kitchen. Now, you can easily cook a great duck with his recipe for glazed duck with pear and rocket salad. By the way, rocket's another name for arugula. Find the recipe on the website, splendidtable.org. The Christian world is heading into Lent and into pancakes. Shrove Tuesday, the day before Ash Wednesday, is Pancake Day. Now, for me, pancakes mean blini. Now, if I'm lucky, they're little blini piled high with caviar. Now, this is how I picture food and travel writer Anya von Bremsen celebrating. She was raised in blini land in Russia. Anya's latest book is The Greatest Dishes Around the World in 80 Recipes. Hey, Anya, good to have you back on the show.
Great to be here.
All right. So is my image of you correct? I mean, I see you on maybe a chaise lounge, sipping champagne and nibbling caviar off of tiny blini. Any reality there?
It's so funny. Why the chaise lounge?
I don't know. I just threw that in for good measure.
It's very tropical. It's just like right in the middle of winter in Russia. Well, it's funny that you should have this image because in America, blini are perceived as like a lifestyle thing. They have to go together with champagne and lots of caviar and they have to be tiny. It's actually pretty far from reality of what the authentic dish is. And I have to start by saying that blini for us, for the Russians, is the most kind of symbolic, ritualistic dish that you can imagine. It goes back to times before Christianity, so pagan celebrations of renewal and regeneration, spring festivities. So the original Russian blini are larger. They're the size of a skillet, like I would say an 8-9 inch skillet, and they represent the sun. Eggs in the blini that you put in the batter represent renewal, rebirth, regeneration. The Russians eat blini at wakes, surprisingly. And traditionally, blini were fed to women after they've given birth. So blini is something that accompanied you from the birth, you know, the entire life cycle from the birth to the end of life. But most importantly, they are eaten right before Lent. What here you have the Shrove, was it Shrove Tuesday, Wednesday?
The Shrove Tuesday.
But in Russia, it's a holiday called the Butter Week or Maslenitsa. And it's an entire week right before Lent when you can eat all the butter and cream, sour cream and eggs that you can do. And Russians really take it seriously. At least historically they have. It wasn't encouraged during Soviet times, but now it's back and it's full force. Maslenitsa, the crazy raucous celebration that you eat blini every day from the morning to night.
So when you say butter and cream, I mean, this is just like an orgy of all the things that you're going to have to give up when Lent comes?
Exactly, which returns with the Easter Sunday when you make the cakes that are again full of butter and eggs. But yeah, you will have to give these up.
So now how do you serve blini then? I realize the caviar is not always there. So what else goes on top of a blini?
Actually, Anton Chekhov, one of our great writers, has a wonderful story called On Human Frailty. And it describes this guy who's piling the blini. First, he puts a little bit of piece of herring, then another salty fish, then a little bit of caviar, then a drizzle of butter, then something else. He opens his mouth in this like erotic anticipation and he drops dead. So it's like this comic, you know, comic little mean little satire on the Russian appetite for blini. But basically you just pile them with everything that you can that's kind of fishy and salty. And I actually like them really straight, just with sour cream and a little bit of jam. Usually Russians wouldn't mix caviar and sour cream. You know, you'd slather them with caviar if you were lucky enough to have caviar. Smoked salmon is definitely traditional. I love blini with herring. Herring maybe sprinkled with a little bit of hard-boiled egg and chopped scallion. That's really traditional. But, you know, something simple, even something basic is like mushroom caviar or eggplant caviar. Anything that you have in a house, you just pile on the blini, you roll it up, and then you plonk it into your mouth.
And now,
and hopefully you don't die.
Well, Chekhov hopefully will not hold true in this case. Now, what about making blini? Are they always done with yeast? And the recipes we see in America often have buckwheat in them.
The blini are always made with yeast, and the process begins with a sponge called apara. And that was a very ritualistic gesture. Some old ladies still cross their sponge, or some in old days they took the sponge to the forest at night so the moon would sing or smile on it. So you let the sponge rise, and then you add flour and eggs. Buckwheat blini were traditional in pre-revolutionary days. After the Soviets took over and all the sort of ingredients disappeared from stores, no one has seen buckwheat flour. And the Russians have forgotten that taste. And I've tried them with buckwheat flour, and it was just like an anachronistic taste. It didn't taste good to me. It was dry and slightly odd. So usually you make them with white flour, eggs, yeast, you know, good, you know, sort of real yeast. And some rise them several times. And it's nice to leave them in the refrigerator overnight so they acquire a slightly sour taste, slightly fermented. And they have to be very thin, the size of a skillet, but fat at the same time. That's the trick. They have to be very spongy and kind of, they have to feel fat in the mouth, but they actually have to be thin, and that's the secret.
So they're very light as well.
They're very light. They're very light and very sort of like a sponge cake.
Sounds like great celebration food. Anya, thank you.
Pleasure.
Anya von Bremsen covers the world's food scenes for Travel and Leisure magazine and other publications. Her latest book is The Greatest Dishes Around the World in 80 Recipes. Now, you can get her recipe for blini on the website, you know, splendidtable.org.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call.
Now, the lines are officially open. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's see who is lined up. We have Pete on the line from Minneapolis. Hey, Pete, what do you want to talk about?
Oh, hello, Lynn. I'm calling because me and some folks in our neighborhood, we are starting a community hen house.
Really?
And, kind of like a vegetable garden, only with a few more feathers.
And an automatic manure producer, right?
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah, we're a bunch of avid gardeners. And having raised chickens before, back at my parents' place out in the country in Minnesota, I know that we're going to be left with lots of extra eggs. And I was looking for recommendations on where I could find cookbooks with a large number of egg recipes.
Well, I'm just trying to think. First of all, there is a book by Marie Simmons. That's it. And I think it's called simply the good egg. And it's nothing but egg recipes.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah. And you know, the other place I would look, because gosh knows the French adore the egg.
Oh, yes.
And if you look at the older cookbooks, and for instance, Julia Child, okay, mm-hmm. Volume 1 of Mastering the Art of French Cooking, there's a whole section on egg cookery. And yeah, and the thing is, you know, the thing about the French, and by the way, I mean, this is true throughout the world, is that an egg to many people is the equivalent of a steak.
Yes.
And it's not just treated as breakfast. It, you know, it's something that you work at 16 ways from Tuesday. I mean, in, for instance, yeah. in Sardinia, there's this sort of, like, they call it music paper bread. It's a very, very, very thin bread.
Oh.
And you could do this with pita or whatever. The idea is that you put garlic and olive oil on it, and you top it with tomato sauce. And you do this all in a big baking sheet, right?
Oh, okay.
And you break two eggs on top of it, and then you put it in the oven for 15 or 20 minutes. And the eggs cook. And the idea is that when you take it out, as you break those eggs, the yolks are still soft. They make even more of a sauce. And you sit there and you're eating supper.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's fabulous. So, it's just, in fact, my mouth is watering at the very thought of the blessed dish. It's a wonderful dish. And the other thing is, I think if you look at Mexico, I'm trying to think where the egg plays a major role, believe it or not.
Yeah, I have a friend from Peru, and when we have dinner parties at her place, there's normally one dish always with egg.
I guess what I'm saying is, look at all these ethnic cuisines, not the mm-hmm. cuisines that are so meat focused.
Yeah.
But the cuisines that are more grain, vegetable focused, and meat as a condiment, because you're going to find dynamite recipes for eggs in those cuisines.
Oh.
And you know, the other place to look is Scandinavia.
Yes. Yes. I have this wonderful recipe, now that you mention it, for a Finnish butter that blends egg with it.
Yeah. I remember a recipe, and again, I don't even know if this is authentic Scandinavian, but someone from Scandinavia made it for me. So I think they were from Sweden. And it was hard-cooked eggs that had been quartered, and they were arranged like the petals of a flower, like in a sunburst.
Oh.
And then they made that sweet, sour dill mustard sauce that you often have with salmon, and they drizzled it over that.
And it was on a simple idea.
It was great. It was on a bed of curly endive, you know, that tart, mm-hmm. snappy green.
Yeah.
It was fabulous, and it was a light supper. You know, hey, that and a beer, and you're home free. I have one worry about your chickens.
Yes.
Tell me you're doing this in the spring and not in the winter.
Yes, we are. The hen house will be built in spring. We're looking at chickens, possibly Japanese quail for their small eggs, and maybe some laying ducks.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, and we'll have, it's very simple to heat them, as I understand it. Back home, we kept them in a warmer part of the garage with just light bulbs that would provide enough heat.
Uh-huh.
And, we're looking at getting lots of different kinds, the brown egg layers and those Araucano that have the different colored shell
eggs. Yeah, they're absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah. But I was really surprised at how simple it was, and most urban cities have a way that you can apply for a permit. I mean, we're right by downtown.
But you know, when you think about it, I'm thinking about other cultures where people keep chickens in the backyard all the time. Hey, good luck with the community hen house, and enjoy the eggs.
Thank you so much for all of your recommendations.
You're welcome, Pete. Take care.
Have a good day. Bye.
You too. Well, it's time for our weekly trivia challenge. Now, the question is, what is the latest alcohol beverage to go on the rocks at the cocktail bar? Now, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be taking more of your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget, one-stop shopping for groceries, cookware, and entertaining. You're going to find them online at target.com/SuperTarget. Oh, hey, we want to welcome a new station to the fold, WFDD Winston-Salem. Good to have you aboard, guys. Now, we're going to be taking more of your calls in a moment. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. But here's the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what's the latest alcoholic beverage to go on the rocks at the cocktail bar? Well, this falls under the headline of anything to make a buck. It is the new cocktail beer. New York Times had a story on this new beer line. In a dumb moment, a beer producer finally noticed how successfully cocktails were selling. So he created the beer equivalent. And he used all the buzz ingredients, ginseng, caffeine, berry flavors, sugar, and guarana. Now, just in case you missed the memo on guarana, it's out of Brazil. It acts just like caffeine. It's been around forever, but it's just gotten noticed lately here. Anyway, back to the cocktail beer. The reporter on the Times piece mentioned a tasting revealed notes of NyQuil in the bouquet. My big question is, do I order my beer cocktail shaken or stirred? Okay, back to the phones. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. Okay, let's see. Who is on the line? We have Marcella calling from Portland, Oregon. Hey, Marcella, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Well, I'm calling because I've been a vegetarian since I was 7 years old, and my parents were vegetarians. And I'm actually switching over to a meat-eating diet now, and I'm finding that I can't find any cookbooks that have just basic recipes. I have no idea how to prepare any kind of meat. I've had a couple disasters.
Yeah, I can imagine.
So I'm just looking for something that would just get me started from scratch. I cooked professionally for a long time as a vegetarian and would like to be able to do, you know, everything that I used to be able to do with tempeh and tofu.
You know, when I said, by the way, I'm not surprised that it was you had problems, is that I didn't mean that it's a reflection on your cooking skills. It's just that this is a different ballgame.
It's completely different.
Yeah,
I was shocked. Even steak fries are different.
And you're a professional at, well, you know, first of all, I think, you know, there's some basic premises. I'm just trying to think. There's a general cookbook out there that I think deals with meat and deals with just about every other subject really well because it kind of streamlines process and still delivers really good taste. You may have heard of it. It's called How to Cook Everything. And it's by someone named Mark Bittman.
Mark Bittman.
Yeah, and he does the minimalist column that appears regularly in the New York Times. And Mark is someone who really does streamline recipes without sacrificing the good stuff. The other thing that occurs to me is, well, there's another book, just realized, that focuses on meat, How to Cook Meat by John Willoughby and Chris Slazinger. And you may have heard John on the show. He's at Gourmet Magazine. But the two of them did. They do a lot on grilling. And then they just did a book called How to Cook Meat.
And but it tells you the basics.
The basics.
How to cut it, all of that.
Yes. And I think if you want to take a look at both those books, they may be really helpful. I'm trying to shy away from the stuff that it gets really deeply involved, because I know for me, it's like with my computer. If someone says, now I want you to learn how a microchip works, you know, I'm out the door. And as much as you're a food professional, I can understand it gets overwhelming. But there's something else that occurs to me. I wonder if it doesn't make sense. What are some of the cuisines you like? Because what I'm thinking is a lot of cuisines that focus a great deal essentially on animal product eating often have a lot of recipes that use meat as a condiment, which is kind of a nice way to get into it. Because, you know, and I'm just thinking like, you know, India, Southeast Asia, Mexico, the Caribbean, China, Japan. There are people who have written some wonderful books that have a lot of vegetarian dishes, but will also have a lot of meat dishes.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them that I like, because she's simple and her stuff just works, if you like Vietnamese or Thai food,
mm-hmm.
her name is Mai, M-A-I, Pham, P-H-A-M.
Mm-hmm.
And anything that she's done, I just think has, they work, they're simple, and they're direct.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that is the one of the great differences between cooking any an animal product
mm-hmm.
versus cooking something like tempeh or, you know, the soy products,
right,
is you are dealing with a tissue structure that sometimes needs to be broken down.
Exactly.
So, for instance, yes. you get a tender steak, right?
Uh-huh.
Sear it over high heat just to get a little bit of brown, then knock down the heat to really low
mm-hmm.
and let it cook really slowly, and that'll do a slow breakdown, and on any tender cut, that'll keep it tender.
Yeah, because what happened was that the first time was exactly the opposite. I did it on high heat like I would have with tofu or
right.
you know, anything else.
And it's tough.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
The dog next door wouldn't even eat it. So
there's a basic overall premise.
Mm-hmm.
It has variations, but the slower you cook protein, the better.
Okay, that sounds great.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
You are welcome. And you know, check in and let us know how it goes.
Okay, I will.
Interesting transition.
Thank
you. Take care, Marcella. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Thanks,
goodbye.
Lynn.
800-537-5252. That's how you can reach us. And let's see, who is up next? We have Ed calling from, is it Chilhowie, Virginia? Did I pronounce it right, Ed?
Yes, Chilhowie.
Aha. Whereabouts in Virginia is that?
That's southwest Virginia. It's right, actually, near the border of Tennessee.
Ah, ham country, I would hope.
Yes.
So,
and the name is a Cherokee word for Valley of Many Deer, which is quite true. We're in the mountains here. It's a beautiful place.
Oh, the mountains in that part of the country are gorgeous. But what did you want? You probably called to talk about something about food,
yes.
right?
Well, I'll tell you, I've been a fan of the soft drink ginger beer for many, many years, and I've just learned about ginger tea. And the more I learn, the more I see that people have many different ways of approaching making these things.
Uh-huh.
And I just wanted to know what you knew about ginger, if you could give me some insight as to the type that we get here in the stores. Is it Asian ginger, or is it domestic? And how do you prepare it, and what things work well with it? In some of these recipes, they say to grate, slice thinly, chop it, pound it, or grind it. And I'm just curious, do you boil it, do you simmer it, do you steep it?
Well, I think to get, first of all, just your last question first. I think the less heat that you apply to ginger, the fresher, brighter, and better it is. If you're making a ginger aid or a ginger beer or a ginger tea, I'd prefer not to cook it. Or to do a minimal amount of cooking, because that wonderful brightness that ginger has, I think it gets muted in cooking. So if you can keep it, you know, closer to being almost raw or actually raw, all the better. Or just have boiling water, for instance, poured over it and let it steep for a little while as opposed to simmering it for a long time. As far as the ginger goes, I think depending on what part of the country you are and where you shop, the origins vary. I shop in some markets that tell you where the ginger comes from. I have seen ginger from California. I've seen ginger from Hawaii. I've rarely seen ginger coming from Asia. But that may be, I'm in the middle of the country. And that just may be that I don't see a lot of that. Now, one of the most delicate, exciting gingers to me is the young ginger. It's green. They call it green ginger sometimes, and maybe you've seen it. You know how normally ginger is a brown-colored skin?
Yes.
Well, with young ginger, it almost looks like bamboo shoots. The skin is pinkish to tinges of green, and it has this sheer skin, and it bounces around in your mouth. It really tastes like a tap dance. It's so alive. And that's one of those cases where you wouldn't want to cook it. I mean, people cook with it, but you don't want to lose that.
Right.
It's just fabulous. But essentially, I think that the key with ginger is it has to be as fresh as possible. And when you buy it, you know when it looks shriveled and old.
Yes.
You know, just doesn't do very well. Also, I tend to like to, if I have the patience, to grate it on a fine grater, because that way I leave behind all the fiber. And if I'm making a drink or something with it, you know, that then that lovely mushy stuff goes into a drink. It's really smooth and silky. If I'm throwing it into a stir fry or something like that, then I leave the, you know, then I just chop it or mince it.
Well, you know, I remember as a young boy, my grandmother in her ice box refrigerator had a ginger jar, and I'd pull that cork off whenever she wasn't looking and munch out on it, and I just loved it ever since. And that was in a liquid.
Well, yeah, it might be in a sugar syrup.
Yes.
Today they call it stem ginger. And in Holland, you eat chunks of it with a knife and fork after a meal as a savory to clear your palate.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, I know. And you can buy it in jars.
Well, that's great.
Yeah. Yeah, and you can also, by the way, store chunks of ginger in sherry. And that's pretty neat because the sherry tastes great and the ginger is delicious, too.
Well, I've been experimenting with all different recipes, and I've blown up a few bottles using brewer's yeast and things, and I think I'll get it. It's a quest that I'm going to keep after.
And you're going to eat so well on the way, and the few disasters, well, you'll learn from them.
Yes, great.
Hey, well, thanks. Thanks for the ginger talk.
Thank you very much.
You are welcome.
Enjoy your show.
Hey, thank you.
Bye.
Goodbye. 800-537-5252. That's how you can reach us. Now, if you're one of the millions of us who are in the Diet of the Month Club, I've got a new one for you. It's the doggy diet. That's right, you diet with your pup. Now, this was a real study done in a real medical school. We have the man who did the study on the phone. He is Dr. Robert Kushner of Northwestern Medical School in Chicago. Dr. Kushner, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Now, I understand you've spent 20 years doing studies on obesity, right?
Right.
But how did the dog thing come about?
Well, you know, I've been working, as you said, with people for so long now, and one of the most important factors that everyone tells me, as well as what's been borne out in the literature, is social support. You know, the ability to buddy up with somebody in order to lose weight seems to be very important. Up until now, buddies have always been considered family, friends, or coworkers. But what people have always forgotten is that there is a very strong human-animal companion bond that exists that provides a lot of social support. And that's been shown very nicely in people with disabilities and heart disease and elderly, but that bond has never been looked at to buddy up for weight loss. So it's taking that background
right.
and buddying up for weight loss. And so we conducted the first ever one-year prospective study of people and pets, both overweight, by the way, and pairing them up together for a combined weight loss program.
Were people paired with their own pets, or were they paired just with pets that were overweight?
No, they were paired with their own pets. In order to get in the study, you had to be overweight, and your pet, in this case a dog, had to be overweight, and you had to be concerned about your dog's health. So you really went in this together as a partnership.
So, how did the diet work? What was the diet for both of these beings?
Well, the people came in on a weekly basis into our center at the Wellness Institute for the first 4 months, and they got information on changing your diet and how to reduce calories, and a very large emphasis on how to increase physical activity. Everyone got a pedometer so they can look at how many steps they're taking and given information on how to have more active and playtime with their dog. At the same time, the dogs saw a veterinarian who were placed on a calorie-restricted diet by Hill's Pet Nutrition, also given information on dog safety tips, you know, dehydration, exhaustion, how to protect the paws against cold weather and heat. So they got the skills, the strategies, and the motivation to be active together and reduce calories.
So walking the dog alone answers half of the problem getting people off their tuchuses and out there moving, right?
Absolutely. You know, it's no surprise that when we entered people in the study, their idea of letting the dog out was, well, just letting the dog
out
and not taking the dog out. And that was a real wake-up call for our participants. Uniformly, at the end of the study, in which both people and pets lost weight successfully, that human-animal companion bond was strengthened. They enjoyed the dog. The dog became more of a central part of the family. When people got home at the end of the day exhausted from work, you got those big brown eyes looking up at you, you know, right at the doorknob, looking at the leash, saying, you're not going to lay down on the couch. You're coming out with me. So that was the incentive that really got people out and walking where they would not have done it before.
So how did it work out?
Well, it worked out that on the average, people lost about 5% of their body weight. That translated into an average of about 11 pounds, although some of our participants lost up to upwards to 30 to 50 pounds. The dogs did much better. They lost 15% of their body weight, some of them losing up to 30 pounds based on the breed. And they kept the weight off out to a year, and that's when the trial ended. And I consider that fairly successful. And I'll add one more thing, Lynn.
Yeah.
I've been doing obesity and weight loss trials for nearly two decades now. This was probably one of the most fun trials I've ever done, where people aren't at the end feeling deprived, exhausted, you know, when can I get back to my old patterns? In this case, they really felt good about themselves and what they were doing.
This is great. Hey, doctor, thank you.
Well, thank you for having me.
I'm just walking my dog, singing my song, strolling along. It's just me and my dog, catching some sun. We can't go wrong. My love is lonely and blue.
Dr. Robert Kushner ran the dog diet study at Northwestern Medical School in Chicago.
Then there was you appeared when I was entangled with youth and fear.
Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this thought on dieting from Ogden Nash. He said, how easy for those who do not bulge to not overindulge. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. Everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to sign up for our weekly newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. It's our attempt to simplify your kitchen life midweek. You'll also find details on our trip to Italy on that very same website. Our producer is Sally Swift with Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Julia Schrankler. Have a great week. Be sure to join us next time. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.